Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, gamer! Greetings, fellow GM and or player. Welcome to episode 103 of Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker, and I'm transmitting to you today from the Obsidian Monolith somewhere outside time and space. I've got another great show for you today. I'm going to be talking about the cleric in D&D. I still don't see a lot of players playing clerics. And I'm going to look at some possible reasons why that might be. With your help, hopefully, I can find some ways to fix the cleric and make it a more attractive option to play. Also today, I'm going to have a world-building segment in which I'll talk a little bit about angels and demons in Primordia. So strap in and get ready for some RPG goodness and roll for initiative. For the main topic of the show today, I wanted to talk about the cleric in D&D, and I've been playing and running D&D for decades, over 20 years now, since the first edition, AD&D days, and all the way through to 5th edition, and through all these years of running the game and playing the game, I've noticed a common thread. Well, there's a lot of common threads, but one common thread that I've noticed is not a lot of people play clerics. I've played with a wide variety of people. I played with people in my hometown growing up in high school. I played with people in college, a few different colleges, actually. I've played with people from other countries, other states, all over the place. And everywhere I've gone, I've seen this tendency to the point that it's, for me at least, it's a remarkable thing when a player rolls a cleric, especially when a player is like, I'm playing a cleric, and it's not a situation where the group decides that they need a cleric and someone needs to take one for the team and play a cleric. And you notice that's a thing I just said that made sense to you, right? I said the group made a decision for someone to take one for the team and play a cleric. That's something we don't say that about any other class in the game. You know, you don't hear about someone taking one for the team and playing a wizard, or taking one for the team and playing a bard, or taking one for the team and playing a fighter. You know, for the most part, in a D&D game, we have this idea of people play what they want to play, and they just make the character they want to make, except in some groups, at least, there is this exception of, well, someone needs to play a healer. And more specifically, sometimes someone needs to play a cleric. Because, yeah, we could have a bard heal or we could have a druid heal, but that's not good enough. We need a cleric. So this is what I've seen. And maybe already you disagree with me. Maybe you're saying, Lex, I see people play clerics all the time. I have a group of players and everybody's playing a cleric. And if that's you, that's awesome. And maybe my experience is some weird outlier and somehow I've just played with people that don't play clerics. I suppose that's possible. So I'd love to hear from you if you have seen the same thing and you see not a lot of players playing clerics, not a lot of players wanting to play clerics, or if you don't and you see lots of people playing clerics, let me know. GameMastersJourney@gmail.com. So for the sake of this discussion, I'm going to assume that this isn't just me. This isn't just the groups that I play with and run for, but that this is a real thing that happens. And why is that? Why is cleric one of the least popular classes in the game, especially considering it's one of the most powerful classes? You'd think it'd be one of the most popular. I've been giving this a lot of thought. I think the cleric, potentially at least, can be a really cool class to play. I think part of the problem is a problem of setting, which I'm going to get into, of, you know, how do clerics work in your setting and how do the gods work in your setting. I think also part of the problem is the dungeon master or the player's perception of the dungeon master or the player not understanding where the dungeon master is coming from as far as how as a DM do you handle the gods? Are they just something out there that maybe exists, maybe don't exist? They're not really relevant. People believe in them or don't, and it doesn't really matter. Or are they very much movers and shakers in your world? Maybe they take physical form and walk around on your world. Maybe their agents are constantly pulling people's strings and making things happen. You know, the answers to those questions can be a big deal to someone considering playing a cleric. It's like, well, if the gods in your world are just kind of out there and they don't deal with people and they're not really relevant, then why would I want to play a cleric? Like, my character isn't going to be special in that way if, you know, my god never talks to me or never manifests, or it never matters in the story that I'm a cleric of this god other than the fact that I can cast healing spells. Or on the other side, you know, maybe your gods are very involved in the world and are movers and shakers and all this thing, all that. And to one player, that might be awesome because they can find a god they can really align with and whose agenda they want to further. But to another player, they might be like, well, I like the cleric in that, you know, I can fight pretty well, I can wear armor, and I have some magic. But I don't want to be playing a cleric in this campaign where the gods are really involved and where things are going to be expected of me because I'm a cleric. So let's look at some possible reasons why clerics might be less popular in the game. And this is a pretty huge discussion, and I gave a lot of thought in how to tackle this. And so the way I've decided to do this is going to be a multi-part discussion. I'm going to come back to this probably a few times in following episodes. So in this first part of the fixing the cleric discussion, what I'm going to talk about is what are the possible reasons that clerics are less desirable to play for players. And then in part two, we'll start getting into what are some things that maybe we can do to solve some of those problems. And the reason, or one of the reasons I'm splitting this up, other than just avoiding an ungodly long episode, is I hope to get some feedback from you between now and the second part, in case maybe there's some possible reasons people don't like playing clerics that I haven't thought of. And I want to make sure to have all the reasons in hand that we can think of before we start thinking too much about solutions. So the first idea I had for a reason that players may not want to play a cleric is perhaps there's a perception that the cleric class just isn't a very good class, mechanically speaking, from a game perspective. Maybe the cleric just isn't a very good class to play compared to the wizard or the paladin or whatever. So I think that this might have actually been a contributing factor in previous editions of D&D. I know, for instance, in second edition, clerics weren't all that great. And I know that a lot of the groups I played in, there were a lot of house rules made to make clerics better and to make them more able to compete with wizards as far as like their power level and to make them more appealing to play. So I know in one D&D campaign I played in the second edition days, clerics were treated kind of like sorcerers are now, in that they knew all the cleric spells, but they didn't have to choose spells ahead of time to memorize. They got to, in the moment, decide what spell they were going to cast. So kind of a prelude to how spells are handled now in fifth edition. So that was one house rule I saw in second edition to try to make clerics better. Unfortunately, I think that made them way too powerful. And in fact, in that campaign that had that house rule, you saw more clerics and not so many wizards because clerics were overpowered. So now everybody wants to play a cleric. So I think that may have been a problem in earlier editions. Third edition, I'm not so sure about. I don't know. Third edition was kind of a mess, but definitely in second edition, I got the feeling as a player, at least, that cleric wasn't maybe the best option mechanically. But I think in fifth edition, I don't think that's the case anymore. And it could be that this edition of D&D is still new enough that some of us, or even a lot of us, are approaching it based more on preconceptions that we have from previous versions of the game that we're familiar with, more than how fifth edition actually is, right? So even though I say that the cleric is a very capable class in fifth edition, and I think is one of the better classes in fifth edition to play, just mechanically speaking, it could be, even if that is true, that it's still perceived as not as good just because people are used to maybe the cleric not being as good in previous editions. So they have this idea in their head of, oh, clerics aren't very good, I don't want to play a cleric. Even though a lot of those problems from previous editions have been fixed in fifth edition, and the cleric is actually a really cool class to play now. Now, I would say in fifth edition, we're definitely lacking in domains as far as playing a cleric. So that is definitely an issue. If you're thinking, oh, I think I want to play a cleric, and then you go looking at the deities and the domains, there's definitely a huge disconnect between the number of deities and the number of domains. And because there really aren't enough domains and the domains aren't specific enough, some of the domains that certain deities get don't really make a lot of sense. It's kind of like Wizards was like, well, we don't really have a domain that really fits this deity, so let's do trickery. Like, for instance, Loth. Does trickery domain really fit Loth as a goddess? I mean, sure, you can make an argument or build a case for how trickery does apply to Loth, but is it, if you could have any domain, is trickery the best domain to describe Loth? Hell no. Treachery, if there were a treachery domain, maybe, but not trickery. You know, you go read about Loth and you don't read anything about her being a trickster. You know, that's not what Loth is about. Trickery does not fit Loth, but it's like, well, we didn't really have a domain to fit her, and we're not going to bother making a domain to fit her, so we'll just give her trickery. And there's a lot of that. If you go through the different pantheons in the Player's Handbook, and the DMG, I think, has some pantheons too, and you look at some of the domains some of the gods get, some of them just don't make sense. So that's definitely a problem, but that is something that is solvable. You know, if you really want to play a cleric in a campaign and you have a god in mind, and that god doesn't really have a domain that fits it, or the domain that's given is kind of lame, you know, you can always get together with your DM and see if your DM would be willing to together come up with a new domain that better fits that god. You know, I can't speak for every DM out there, but I think a lot of DMs would be open to that, especially if you're talking a homebrew setting, because that's probably, like me, that DM probably has that on the back burner anyway of something to do, is like, hey, there aren't really domains to fit all my gods. I need to come up with new domains. But it can be kind of a squeaky wheel gets the grease kind of thing. So something like that may not actually happen until you have a player that wants to play a cleric of that god and is like, hey, can we have a better domain for this god? And the DM's like, yeah, you know, actually, I've been meaning to do that. And since you want to play a cleric of that deity, I'm going to get on that and let's come up with a better domain. But even with the lack of domains, there are still more choices for cleric than there are for a lot of the classes. I mean, if you look at each domain as an archetype for the class, I mean, clerics get way more archetypes than, you know, the bard or the fighter. You know, they get like 3. Clerics get, I don't know, 7 or 8 or something. So there's still a lot of variety there to build a character. You just may not be able to make the perfect character for a particular deity without your DM being willing to house rule new domains. But even so, I'd say, you know, cleric is one of the most capable and powerful classes in the game. I'd say cleric and wizard are still the two most powerful classes in the game, as it should be, I think. So yeah, the whole, you know, the cleric just isn't a good class, that could be part of the problem, but I think it's a small part of the problem, if it even is part of the problem. So another possible reason that people don't want to play cleric is they don't want to be stuck as a party healer. I think this is a big one. I think this reason and the next reason I'm going to talk about after this are the majority of the problem. And this is the one I hear the most from players, is I don't want to be a heal bot. So I think there is a problem here, but the problem is not with the cleric class, and the problem isn't necessarily even with the design of D&D as a game. The problem is with the perception of players and DMs and how the game is run at people's table and how people approach character creation and how people approach party creation and party makeup. So there's this idea and this perception that you have to have a healer, right? And this is pretty common. You know, you will find groups out there who feel that they need the basic four, and it's like, we got to have a rogue, we got to have a wizard, we got to have a cleric, and we got to have a fighter, or at least we have to have people filling those roles. There are people that play that way. I think those people are rare these days. I think that the game has been improved in design to the point where that isn't true anymore. I think in the old days that was more true, but I think in fifth edition that isn't true. You don't need a rogue in every party. You don't need a wizard in every party, et cetera, et cetera. Again, this is more a thing, I think, of how you run your particular game than it is anything inherent in the game itself, because there's nothing in the game, at least not in fifth edition, that says you need a healer. Now, I do remember that terrible fourth edition player's handbook that tried to turn D&D into an MMO, where they were basically like, you need heals, tank, and DPS in your party. It's like, are you fucking kidding me? Be gone, fourth edition. We will speak of you no more. But anyway, other than that, you know, we the player's handbook in fifth edition doesn't say anything like you have to have a healer, right? So that right there is, you know, a perception that people are bringing to the game that's not in the game. And I guess the question we can ask is, do you really need a healer? And if you do, does that healer need to be a cleric? Now, my personal experience and my opinion on this is that a healer is really only needed for things like restoration, greater restoration, you know, getting rid of diseases and curses and stuff like that, remove curse, and your raise dead resurrection type spells. Like, that's what you really need a healer for. You know, if you're sitting here making characters as a group and someone's saying, or you're all saying, we need a healer, I hope that's what you're thinking. I hope that you're thinking, we need a healer in case someone gets a disease or someone gets cursed or someone gets their arm chopped off, or someone dies and they want to bring their character back and not make a new character. That's why we need a healer or a cleric. We don't need a healer just to give people hit points. Because first of all, out of combat, there are plenty of ways for everybody to get hit points. You can short rest, you can long rest. There are healing potions. Getting hit points back isn't a problem in this edition of the game anymore. You know, in like second edition, you know, you would rest all day and get like a fraction of your hit points back, you know? So it's like, if you didn't have an actual healer, it took days of time to fully heal everybody up. And there was really no mechanism for getting any substantial amount of hit points in less time than a full night's rest. So in those days, you really did kind of need a healer or someone that can give people hit points. But in fifth edition, you don't. You can spend an hour and people can roll hit dice and get hit points back. And in a long rest, you get all your hit points back. So in this edition, what you really need a healer for is things other than hit point damage. Things like ability damage or losing a limb, or, you know, something you need restoration spell for, or something like someone dies, you need raise dead or resurrection for. So these kinds of things, you know, these heals that you need outside of combat, right? Like your restoration, your raise dead and stuff like that. These are things NPCs can do. So you don't necessarily need a player character in the party for that. Another nice thing about, you know, if you have a party of player characters and they don't have a quote healer and they're having to go to a temple or something to get restoration or get someone raised from the dead or whatever, is those are excellent money sinks. And I'm going to come back to this a little later, but I think if you even allow NPCs to cast spells for player characters, and if you allow spells as powerful as like Raise Dead or Greater Restoration to be cast, it should cost a buttload of money. you know, and I hear people saying all the time that there's not enough things to spend your money on in fifth edition, to spend your gold on, which I don't actually agree with. And maybe that's a topic for another episode. What do you think? Is there enough to spend your gold on in fifth edition D&D? Would that be a good topic? Because a lot of people seem to think that there's not. And I think that there's plenty of ways for your player characters to spend their gold. If you're a DM and you have a problem where your player characters have way too much money and they don't have anything to spend it on, there are a million ways to fix that problem. It's not hard. Just start looking through your books and you'll find things they can spend that money on. But yeah, that's a topic for another day. So yeah, if they don't have a healer, they can pay an NPC for the healing that they need. It's going to cost them a lot of money, which is a good money sink, which leads to more adventuring because you need more money. Now, the other idea people sometimes have when they say we need a healer in the party is they're thinking about actual healing during combat. Like you're in combat fighting monsters and you want one of the player characters to be spending their turns healing people. Now, that's just tactically not a great way to handle combat. If you want to think of combat from a tactical point of view, spending your action to give another PC hit points is usually not the best use of that action. You're usually better off doing damage to the thing that you're fighting, or maybe buffing someone or casting some kind of crowd control or something like that. Usually the last thing you want to do, you're better off just making a normal attack than just healing someone to heal someone. About the only time it's a good idea to cast some kind of healing spell in combat is if someone's in danger of failing a death save. You know, if someone's got two failures and you're worried that they're going to roll another failure on the death save, you know, that's a good time to do something, right? But again, you don't need a cleric or a healer to do that. In fact, you don't even need to heal them. All you need to do is stabilize them. And in fact, I would argue tactically that it's much smarter to stabilize a downed PC in combat than it is to heal them. And I'll get to that in a second, why that is. So in order to stabilize a downed PC, any player character can do that with a medicine roll, which is a wisdom check if you don't have medicine. And it's only a DC 10. So chances are good that you've got at least a couple characters in the party that have a better than 50-50 chance of passing that roll, even if they don't have the medicine skill, just with their wisdom bonus. It's not hard to do. Another possibility is getting the healer's kit, which makes it even easier and actually gives them some hit points back too. And there's also the cantrip that someone in your group might have, which it's slipping my mind. Is it Spare the Dying? I think. But anyway, there's a cantrip that automatically stabilizes someone. So there's that option too. None of which involve casting Cure Wounds. So I said, you know, you don't want to usually heal someone who goes down. And the reason is, and I've seen this happen so many times, more times than I can count. This is what happens, okay? The PCs are fighting a group of monsters. One of the PCs gets knocked to zero hit points, laying on the ground, rolling their death saving throws, right? Healer runs up, a bard, a cleric, whatever, cast Cure Wounds or Holy Word on the downed character. Character heals a few hit points, stands up, and the next round they get knocked down again. Because the thing is unless you're casting Cure Wounds or Holy Word or Healing Word, sorry, as a high level spell, like say higher than, I don't know, fourth or fifth level, it's not going to heal that many hit points, and chances are really good that one or two more hits and that character goes down again anyway. So what's the point in wasting your action and one of your spell slots to bring someone up just so that they can get knocked down again, and now they're making death saves again? You're much, much better off just stabilizing them. Now, yes, if they're stabilized and they take some damage in some way, now they're making death saves again, but then you just stabilize them again. All you wasted was an action. You didn't waste a spell slot. And if you're high enough level to cast a high-level cure spell that's actually going to give them a decent buffer of hit points, well, then you're higher level and the monsters are doing much more damage, and so it's still probably not enough to keep them up for more than a round or two, if that. So it's a waste of time and resources. So I think a lot of this idea of we need a healer is left over from previous editions. because, again, I don't think all the realities of 5th edition have completely sunk in for everybody yet. You know, you don't really need the healer so much anymore. You know, the big reason you needed a healer in the past was to heal hit points in between fights. And you don't need that anymore because you have the short rest. You can roll hit dice. And your long rest, you get all your hit points back. Also, another part of this, you know, I don't want to play a cleric because I don't want to be a healer is, well, clerics aren't the only characters in the games that can heal. Druids and bards get access to healing spells, as do rangers. So, you know, just because you are the cleric doesn't mean that you have to be the one casting healing spells if that's something that the people in your party think is a worthy thing to do during combat. So again, I think where the cleric really shines here is in the spells like Restoration and the various forms of Resurrection and Raise Dead. You know, a lot of times, you know, the bard or the druid, you know, they don't get all those spells necessarily. So, you know, as far as just being able to heal everything in sight, you know, clerics are where it's at because they've got the best selection of spells for that. And of course, if you play a life cleric, then you get all kinds of extra abilities with healing above and beyond your actual spells, which, you know, makes the life cleric the probably hands down best healer in the game. But again, you know, that's if you think you need someone to be a quote healer. I think that 5th edition works a lot better when every PC kind of worries about their own healing. Again, you've got short rests, long rests. Some character classes have some self-healing abilities. For instance, the fighter has a second wind, and of course, potions and other magic items. And the whole, you know, the clerics being the best source of ways to come back from the dead without being reincarnated into God knows what, I think you can actually use that as more of an incentive to play clerics by saying that you're not going to be able to most times find an NPC to cast Raise Dead for you. It's going to be nearly impossible. You know, the way I look at the game is, you know, your average priest in a temple somewhere doesn't have any spells. You know, there's a difference between a cleric, which is a player character class, and a priest that's just someone that follows a religion. You know, it's only the ones that are chosen by the gods that have powers, right? Your average priest or whatever doesn't. Like, that's just the way I approach it. It's kind of a more old school way of looking at how clerics work. But the thing about that is, you know, you can't just assume that every little village has someone that can cast cure spells on you or sell you potions, right? You're probably more likely to find potions for sale than you are to find someone who can cast a cure spell on you. I mean, let's face it, in a world where healing potions exist, they'd be everywhere. Everybody would want to have some of those in their village, right? Just for emergencies, if nothing else. So if players can find an NPC to cast something like Resurrection or Raise Dead, first of all, it should be hard to do. It should only be possible in like the really large cities in your world. And even then, you know, it shouldn't be guaranteed, you know, like, well, maybe there is a cleric that can do it in this temple, but unless you're a follower of that god, they're not going to do it for you. So even if you find an NPC to cast one of those spells, it should cost a ridiculous amount, you know. So perhaps a step in fixing the cleric is establishing for your players that, hey, if you want a good chance of your character coming back if you die, then having a player play a cleric is a good way to go, because I'm going to tell you right now that it's not guaranteed that you're going to be able to find NPCs to cast healing spells, period. And it's certainly not guaranteed that you're going to find an NPC powerful enough to cast Resurrection or Raise Dead and willing to do it for you. And even if all that lines up, it may likely cost more than you have. And when I talk about Resurrection costing a ridiculous amount, I'm talking a sizable percentage of the resources of the entire party. I'm not talking about, you know, your player characters have hundreds of thousands of gold and someone's like, I want 10,000 gold to cast Resurrection. No, it's like they want half of what your players have. So if your players have 200,000 gold, this guy wants 100 grand to cast Resurrection. That's what I'm talking about when I say expensive. Also, another thing to think about, you know, if you're going this route of saying, you know, and this is kind of fixing another thing that people perceive as a problem, which is, you know, resurrection being too easy in the game. And my answer to that is always resurrection is as easy as the DM wants it to be. Just because it's a spell in the player's handbook doesn't mean any of the player characters can cast it. Doesn't mean that there are NPCs on every street corner that can cast it. It just means that's a possibility. Just like there's a Vorpal sword in the DMG, doesn't mean that every town guard has a Vorpal sword, right? It just means that's a possible sword someone could have. So, you know, if you think there's too much resurrection in the game, then don't have so much resurrection in your game. Don't have NPCs casting it. Only allow it to be available if a player character is able to cast it and actually knows the spell and can cast it, not from a scroll or a magic item that you've given them. So, you know, something to tell a player who's maybe considering playing a cleric, and you're telling them, hey, you know, one nice thing about having at least one person play a cleric in the party is it gives you access to raise dead and resurrection, which otherwise you're just not going to have. If you don't have a cleric, that's just probably not going to be on the table for you. Your character dies, you're dead. It's just the way it works. A player might still be a little like, well, I don't know, because, well, now I'm not a heal bot, but I'm a raised dead bot. And it's like, well, you know, you should role play this, right? Don't just cast resurrection on PCs because they're PCs, right? A cleric wouldn't just raise anybody from the dead. The cleric would have a really good, have to have a really good reason to raise someone from the dead. And I think you're my buddy or you're my adventuring companion. I don't know that that'd be a good enough reason for a lot of clerics. Clerics are given a lot of power, right? And I'm sure that most clerics, if not all clerics, learn that with great power comes great responsibility. So they're not going to just raise dead willy-nilly on just anybody. So I think that, I mean, this is going to be individual, a character-based decision, but it could be based on the character of this person. You know, so if we're talking about the rogue in the party who has shown himself to be less than moral and not necessarily a very good person, although, you know, he's good in a fight, maybe the cleric wouldn't resurrect that guy. Maybe he wouldn't feel comfortable doing that. Or maybe the cleric wants compensation. Maybe he's like, hey, you know, and of course, this would probably have to be something you agree ahead of time. But he's like, hey, I'm, you know, if the time comes, I'm willing to resurrect you, but you need to make a donation to my church in this amount or whatever, right? Might have, the cleric might have some conditions. You know, think about what resurrection really means in the world and to that character casting that spell. Is this person someone that your God would want you to bring back? If the answer to that question is anything other than a resounding yes, then your cleric character should probably expect a lot from this person or from someone to convince you to bring them back in the first place. All right, so we've covered two possible reasons people don't want to play clerics so far. The perception the class just isn't that good, which I'm thinking at this point is a marginal reason, if it even is a reason. But I think a big one is this one we just discussed, that they don't want to be stuck as the party healer. Now, my final reason, this is actually kind of a few reasons kind of put together. And I think this is another big part of it. I think this and not wanting to be the healer are 90% of the reason that people don't want to play clerics. And that's the whole religion thing. This is really a can of worms. This is really a lot of different reasons for different people. But it all falls under this whole religion thing. And it's all kind of related. So the first reason might be that the player sees religion as distasteful or undesirable. And, you know, this is a big one for me personally. You know, me personally, I actually really like clerics as a class, and I actually enjoy playing clerics, but I will only play clerics in certain settings and certain campaigns and with certain DMs, because for me, it's very much tied up in what the gods are, what the DM's idea of the gods are. Are they perfect, infallible beings or not? Are they all powerful or not? And how active they are in the world and stuff like that. And I really personally need to have a good grasp of what the gods are like in this setting and how they fit into the world before I even know if cleric is something I'm willing to consider. You know, a lot of us are turned off by religion and or religious people in the real world. You know, so this carries over to the gaming table. You know, few people that I know want to play the Jehovah's Witness going door to door peddling their religion. You know, most people don't want to play that. Few people want to play the character that sees their God's hand in every little thing that happens and or is constantly telling the other people in the party about the glories of their deity. I think this is a big part of it. And I've seen this a lot in groups I played with. People don't want to play that character and people don't want to be in a party with that character because it's annoying. It's obnoxious. And, you know, we have to deal with annoying and obnoxious stuff all the time in the real world. So most of us kind of like to avoid the annoying and obnoxious things in our role-playing games. Perfect example of what I'm talking about here. For those of you that have seen True Blood, you remember the Newlands from True Blood? You remember Sarah Newland from True Blood and how batshit crazy that girl was and how she could spin anything that happened so that it fit into her religious worldview and, oh, this was all meant to be and this all perfectly makes sense to me. You know, that's what I'm talking about. That annoys the shit out of people and people don't want to play it. People don't want to play with that. So that's what a lot of us think of when we think of a religious person. So we think of a cleric and that's what we think of. You know, perfect. Another perfect example of this, if you check out Chris Perkins' Curse of Strahd campaign that he's streaming, there's a player playing a paladin in that game. And I think it's a funny character and, you know, whatever, but really obnoxious, annoying religious character. And the other player characters are all find that character obnoxious. I don't know how much the actual players do, but the characters definitely do. You know, so that's a perfect example of the kind of dynamic I'm talking about and the kind of thing that I think a lot of people just don't want. And so they just pass the cleric by. But you don't have to play a cleric that way. And I don't think you should play a cleric that way. I think all of that is coming from our monotheistic Judeo-Christian worldview. And it doesn't really, when you start really thinking about a polytheistic world, it doesn't really fit. But, you know, that's a problem with D&D from the beginning is it's been this monotheistic Christian idea shoehorned into polytheism. And there's reasons for that in the history of D&D that, I don't know, I could talk about someday. It's definitely interesting. But yeah, moving on. Another possible issue here is a player may be uncertain about the gods, their role in the world, and how the DM is going to use the gods, and how the DM is going to use the player's character, the cleric's relationship with the gods and with their particular god. So if you're going to play a cleric, you know, and I kind of talked about this is how I am, you need to know about the gods, or at least you need to know about the god your character is going to worship. And this can be rough for newer players or any player that's not familiar with the particular setting that the game is taking place in, whether that's a published or a homebrew setting. And personally, I think it's pretty much impossible to make a cleric without first knowing about the gods. I mean, choosing your deity is the most fundamental choice that you make with a cleric character. You also have to be able to find a deity that you really like. You know, you have to find a god that you can say, hey, I would have a lot of fun playing a cleric of this god. You know, that's one of my problems with the Forgotten Realms pantheon is with the exception of some of the evil gods, I don't find any of the Forgotten Realms gods interesting enough to want to play a cleric of that god. It's like, this god is so boring and generic. Like, there's nothing that inspires me about this god. Now, there are some good gods out there. For instance, Pathfinder has a god. I can't remember his name. I remember it was kind of a dumb name, but has a god who was basically a mortal who was a drunk and passed this test somehow and became a god. So he's like the drunk guy at the bar that became a god. That's kind of a cool concept. I don't know that I'd play a character of that. Okay, no, I wouldn't play a character of that god. But it that right there has more to it than any of the Forgotten Realms gods as far as giving you some personality for this deity, something to work with. So you want to find a deity that you really like and that you can agree with because you're going to be furthering this deity's agenda. And depending on the pantheon or pantheons of the world you're playing in, that may be more or less difficult or impossible. You also want to know where the DM is coming from when it comes to the gods. How involved are the gods going to be in the story? How much will your particular god be commanding you to do things as a cleric? How hard or how easy will it be to piss off your god and lose all your powers? What does your god expect from you, really? All these questions have to be answered before the cleric can even really be considered. I think a lot of this really comes down to a fear of loss of agency on the part of the player. I think a lot of times players worry that if I play a cleric, I'm giving the DM too much leverage over my character because I have to do whatever my god says. And if I don't, I lose all my class abilities. And that's, you know, that's really scary. And in a way, it's even worse than the paladin because at least the paladin, you have your code, right? You know, at least a paladin, you have a pretty clear idea of what's expected of you as a paladin. But clerics are much more, well, it depends on the particular deity, right? Clerics don't have one unified code of justice that they stand for. Each cleric has his own code based on his own deity. And, you know, unfortunately, the player's handbook is not very helpful in this. It doesn't, when it's talking about the domains, it doesn't talk about the deities at all. It doesn't tell you this is what this deity expects of you. And this is how often this deity will ask you to do things. And this will be how strict your deity is about you keeping your vows and all. Like, there's none of that. That's all up to the DM to come up with. So, of course, DMs are going to come up with that, and you can have a wide variety between DMs and different campaigns as to how much agency a cleric player has and how much, you know, they're at the whim of their gods. So because of all these things, I think the cleric is one of the classes that's most rooted in the setting of the game. How awesome or not a cleric is to play, I think, has a lot to do with the setting. Who are the gods and what are they like? How much do they interfere with worldly events? What do they expect of their clerics? Playing a cleric in a world where the gods are aloof and uninterested in mortal affairs is very different than playing a cleric in a world where the gods walk the earth and smite those who anger them. So I think all of these factors play a role. And obviously, you know, we're all individuals, so different factors will probably play more into some players than others. But I do think that probably the biggest contributors in general are the not wanting to be stuck as the party healer and the issues of the religion and setting and understanding what does being a cleric really mean and how much influence is my god going to have over my character. I think the first problem, not wanting to be stuck as the healer, is mainly a problem of the players at the table. This is a problem of preconceptions and misconceptions and perceptions. And there's not really anything I can do to fix that. That's something it's up to each group to fix. If you want to play a cleric, my advice is discuss it with the group in session zero. So you're in session zero, you're making characters. If you're thinking about playing the cleric, have a discussion with the group about it. If you don't want to be a heal bot, make that clear. I think it's perfectly valid, for example, to make a war cleric who doesn't prepare any healing spells at all. If that's the kind of character you want to play, that's great. Tell the group in session zero, say, hey guys, I'm going to play a cleric, but I'm going to be mixing it up in melee and casting battle magic. I'm not going to be casting heals. You know, communicate. So many of these issues, the answer is communication. So I think if everybody communicates in session zero, that, you know, unless you're playing with a bunch of dicks, in which case find a different group, you're not going to be put into that heal bot role if you don't want to be. The other problems of the cleric, I think, can be solved through the setting. They all boil down to the nature of the gods, how they interact with their followers, and what they expect from them. I think these problems can be solved with a two-pronged approach. So prong number one, we make the gods interesting, and we make them involved in the story and the setting so that they're relevant. It's not just something that doesn't matter. We make clerics special. Clerics are the true chosen ones of their deities. They're special. Most religious types, priests, things like that, they don't cast spells. They don't get special notice from their gods. Only clerics cast spells. Well, and paladins, of course. And I think we can further shore this up by coming up with things in our setting and with our deities to give DMs guidance as far as bringing the gods into play and having the gods give your character a boon or some kind of blessing or some kind of favor. And what you can do to bring those about and how you can get those and what they do for you and things like that. The second prong is as a DM to communicate to your players exactly how you're going to handle clerics and gods in the game. For example, in Primordia, I would tell players that as a cleric, you have your god's ear. You are more likely to receive blessings from your god and even other gods than other characters are. This can and will go above and beyond actual game mechanics and what's in the game, like your spells and divine intervention ability. As a DM, make the gods central to the campaign, at least if you have a cleric PC, and let the players know this. You know, if you're in session zero and a player is considering making a cleric and they're debating it, you can tell them, hey, you know, the gods are going to be very active behind the scenes in what's going on, and having one or more of them on your side and on the party side will be very helpful and can lead to opportunities that you won't have otherwise. So what do you think? Do you see fewer players playing the cleric? If so, why do you think that is? Are there some possibilities that I missed? If you also see this problem in your groups, do you have any ideas on how to solve it? I have a few ideas of my own, and I will be discussing those in part two of this discussion in a future episode. But hopefully, between now and then, I will hear from you, and maybe you'll give me some good ideas I haven't thought of that I can share with the listeners. The best thing about this podcast is the feedback that I get from you. I would love to hear from you, whether it's comments on a topic I've discussed, requests for a future topic, feedback on the show, ideas for Primordia, anything you'd like to send my way, or just say hi. I'd love to hear from you. You can email me at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Lex Starwalker. You can follow me on Google plus Lex Starwalker. And you can visit my website, starwalkerstudios.com. You can find all my podcasts there. You can find my show notes there for all of the Game Master's Journey episodes. You can also find a link to the Game Master's Journey Google Plus community, which you can join and have discussions with other listeners and gaming nerds. You can also check out the Primordia subreddit if you'd like to help participate in world building Primordia at reddit.com/r/primordia. And also you can find a link to my YouTube channel at starwalkerstudios.com where I have all kinds of actual play videos. I want to send a huge thank you and shout out to my tier 6 patron, Steve Strickland. Let's hear it for Steve. Patrons get some cool perks for supporting the show, including a special monthly podcast I do just for the patrons and access to original game material that I share with the patrons and much more. And becoming a patron is a great way to support the show and support Starwalker Studios and keep Game Master's Journey going. So you can become a patron today at patreon.com/starwalkerstudios.
This is Matthew Colville, and you're listening to Game Master's Journey.
For today's world-building segment, I'm going to talk just a little bit about angels in Primordia And I want to thank Rob Whitaker on Google Plus for giving me the idea to talk about this on the show. He was asking about Angels in Fantasy in Google Plus, and I've actually been thinking about this quite a bit myself lately and came up with some interesting things for Primordia of ways to handle the angels. So angels have been portrayed different ways, and not just angels, but celestials in general have been portrayed in different ways through the different editions of D&D and in Pathfinder. I think the best kind of categorization of them that I've seen so far is in Pathfinder. So in Pathfinder, the angels are just one type of celestial, and they're neutral good and serve neutral good deities, which makes sense. So angels would be like solars and planetars. Archons, for example, the trumpet archon, are lawful good celestials and serve lawful good deities. Again, makes sense. The Azada, for example, the Gale, are chaotic good celestials and serve chaotic good deities. All makes sense, right? Right down the line. So this is in parallel to how devils are lawful evil and demons are chaotic evil. We have the same kind of thing with the fiends. In 3.5, angels were just any good alignment. However, the archons were lawful good. So there we have a parallel in both Pathfinder and D&D 3.5. Archons were lawful good. But again, I think Pathfinder's classification makes the most sense just because, you know, they divided it up between these are the lawful celestials, these are the neutral, and these are the chaotic. Now, 5th edition, unfortunately, has muddied the water here quite a bit because there's only angels in the Dungeon Master's Guide, or the Monster Manual. We don't have Archons or Azada or anything like that. And their alignment has been changed from neutral good in Pathfinder or any good in 3.5 to lawful good. So we only have angels and they're lawful good. So you might think, well, then the neutral and chaotic good deities are SOL because there's no celestials for them. But no, the 5th edition Monster Manual is saying all the good deities have angels, even if they're not lawful good. And the rationale here is that they want servants that do what they're told. So even a chaotic good deity wants lawful good angels because they want angels that do what they're told. I mean, I get where they're coming from there. And let's face it, it's really just a great way to avoid having to have the other celestials in the Monster Manual. But it really breaks down pretty quick when you start thinking about it. Usually denizens of the outer planes match the alignment of their plane. So lawful good angels serving a neutral good deity on a neutral good plane doesn't really make sense or hold up well unless we're just throwing alignment out. But in all previous editions of D&D, and in this current edition, each plane is associated with alignment. So a lawful good deity lives on a lawful good plane. A neutral good deity lives on a neutral good plane. So it doesn't make sense to have a neutral good deity living on a neutral good plane, but served by lawful good celestials that are living on a neutral good plane. It doesn't make any sense. So I think that this is something that any DMs out there who are running in a homebrew world, or even if you're using a published setting, it's something that you probably want to think about if you're going to use the outer planes or celestials or divine agents. So this is something that I thought about, and I actually came at this a little differently. I didn't even come at it from the problem with angels being lawful good and, you know, neutral good deities having lawful good deities, although that was definitely in my mind as an issue. But my issue came with my, quote, evil gods. And in Primordia, my gods actually don't have alignments. And someday I'm going to have to go into this in detail. I kind of hedge around a bit because there are some reveals that I want to do in my campaigns in Primordia about things about the gods that this kind of ties into, and I don't want to spoil those on the show. So just suffice it to say that in general, my gods don't have an alignment per se or another way, maybe a better way to say it, is they have multiple alignments. They can even have conflicting alignments. And it comes down to the aspects. So my gods have different aspects. You know, every group of people that worships a different deity may have their own spin on that deity, and that's an aspect of that deity. And those aspects can be different alignments. So, for example, Hades, my god of death, you know, I might normally say, oh, Hades is probably like neutral evil or lawful evil, right? Or maybe lawful neutral, like somewhere in there. Like he's floating around in the lawful neutral, lawful evil area, maybe. But there are groups of people who worship Hades as an evil deity, and there are groups of people that actually worship Hades as a neutral deity. I don't know that anybody actually worships him as a good deity, although that it's theoretically possible, but there are definitely people that worship him as a neutral deity. And, you know, Hades as a deity is neither or all of them, because again, alignment is a mortal conception. It's not, it doesn't really apply to deities, but he definitely, you know, has aspects that are different alignments. So the aspect worshiped, you know, in this one city is lawful neutral, and the aspect worshiped in this other city is neutral evil. So, you know, thinking about all this, I'm like, you know, I want my god of death to have angels. You know, because the idea in the Monster Manual and D&D seems to be that evil gods are served by demons and devils, which to me just doesn't make sense. I mean, devils serve archdevils and demons serve demon lords, and they all just kind of serve themselves, right? I don't really see devils or demons as being the lackeys of a deity. That's what angels are. So the way I decided to go about this is to say for Primordia, demons and devils, you know, they've got their own thing going on. So the demons are following the demon lords. The devils are following the archdevils. They have their own things going on. That has nothing to do with the deities. They're totally different creatures, totally different animals, totally different types of entities. They're not even related at all. Deities have angels, and you know, they're probably not all going to be called angels. Probably each deity will call its servant something different. But every deity has them, and the deities create them. And those celestials match the alignment of the deity, or the alignment of that particular aspect of the deity, or the alignment that the deity wants it to have, whatever. So the idea is, for instance, Hades has angels, and I've actually statted them up and made them up. I call them reapers, as in grim reapers, and they are literally angels. They are celestials. They are angels. They do angel-like things, but they're not lawful good. In fact, I think they're lawful evil, but mainly they're just lawful. They do what Hades tells them to do. I think they're lawful evil. They might be lawful neutral, but they're not lawful good. They are not good, and they serve Hades. And, you know, I'm going to have angels for all of my deities. They'll all have different angels, and those angels will match that deity's persona. So this idea of having a lawful good angel as a catch-all for every god, I think it's pretty lame. Kind of phoning it in there, wizards, I feel like, especially when you have such a rich history through the history of D&D of other celestials, to just limit us to angels and say they're lawful good, and that all good deities have lawful good angels serving them. That doesn't fly for me. But that's the beauty of homebrewing, is you can do your own thing. So Hades' angels tend to be lawful evil, but that doesn't mean that every angel of Hades, or reapers, as I call them, is lawful evil. Fiends and celestials are created with a stock alignment. I mean, they're created with an alignment, okay? So When a demon is pooped out by the abyss, it's pooped out chaotic evil, right? When Hades fashions a new reaper, he fashions that reaper lawful evil. But these are intelligent, sentient beings, just like player characters. And just like player characters, they have freedom of choice, which means that their alignment can and will change. And that's how and why we have fallen angels. And this is even canon. What is it? Zariel, I think, is one of the lords of one of the levels of the Abyss and is a fallen angel. Now, I mean, maybe if you found stats for Zariel, they've changed the type from celestial to fiend or something like that. That could be. But the fact is Zariel is an angel who is no longer good, who is evil and lives in the Abyss. Because again, you're living in a plane that matches your alignment. So just as an angel can fall to evil, I think a demon could rise to good. It's probably not very likely to happen. I wouldn't hold my breath waiting for it to happen, but it's within the realm of possibility. And that is fodder for a very interesting story. So that's one thing I'm really trying to do with Primordia is to kick people out of their preconceptions and their assumptions in regards to alignment and getting rid of this simplistic kind of elementary moral view of black and white and things are either good or evil and get to a more realistic, more adult moral view, kind of like Game of Thrones, you know, like John Marvin brought up the other week, you know, of where, you know, people aren't good. People aren't bad. People do good things. People do bad things. People have good reasons. People have bad reasons for what they do. And it's complicated, right? And that's, I would argue one of the reasons Game of Thrones is so successful is, you know, those characters are not cliches. They're not just archetypes. You know, Jaime Lannister isn't the noble knight, but he's not the fallen knight either. They're not falling into those tropes. They're more real people because of it. And, you know, if you want to have a D&D experience that's very, I don't know, simplistic and morally, you know, black and white and, oh, we just kill all the orcs because orcs are evil and that's all there is to it, then fine, you know, run the game that you want to run. But for me, you know, I like a more intelligent game. I like characters, whether they're my characters, my NPCs or player characters, that make sense and act like real people. To me, that builds the immersion, that makes it feel more like a real thing that I'm doing than just some fantasy if, you know, human nature is shown accurately. And I think that it is silly, to put it the nicest way I could put it, to not apply that to other sentient beings in the game and say, oh, only humans have a choice in alignment, but, you know, dragons are what they are and demons and angels are what they are and orcs and goblins are what they are and they can't have a choice on their alignment. They just are what they are, but humans can choose, or player characters can choose, but NPCs can't. That's silly. So yeah, there's a little bit about how I'm handling angels. And I think, you know, this is kind of a cool illustration of how you can take something that's kind of a problem in the game or in the setting that you're working with, and you can actually use it as a way to further codify your setting and make your world more your own and make it more unique. You know, I started out with this problem of all angels are lawful good and all good deities have lawful good angels, which doesn't make sense to me. And this problem of, you know, these beings being locked into an alignment, even though they're intelligent beings with free will, which doesn't make sense to me. And by finding solutions to those problems, which is namely, I'm coming up with different types of angels for all my different deities, not only do I now have answers to these questions that are more satisfying to me, but now I have all these cool new angel types and new possibilities for NPCs based on all these types of angels. You know, getting a messenger from the god of death is going to be very different than getting a messenger from the god of nature, right? The god of nature might send a unicorn instead of an angel. Who knows? But the point is, it's led me to come up with new ideas for my world that makes my world more my own and more unique and more interesting and a more interesting place for players to explore, which I think, you know, if you're building your own world, like that's really what you want to go for, is you want to try to make your world interesting and have mysteries, you know, have things going on behind the scenes that the players don't know about. So these fact, you know, the fact that the gods have different angels and what they're like probably isn't something that's commonly known in Primordia. That's something players will discover, and they'll be able to, as they campaign through the world, start learning, oh, this is what the god of death's angels are like, and this is what the god of love's angels are like. And they're all going to be very different and very unique. And that will be fun for players to discover and learn about. And, you know, kind of bringing this back into our theme today about the cleric in D&D, you know, and what I'm going to get into a lot in the next episode is that I really think a lot of the problems and perceived problems with the cleric can really be solved through a combination of setting design and how you approach the gods and how you approach clerics as a DM. And I don't think we need to change really anything mechanically in the game or in the cleric class. It's just how we approach it and how we present it. And I think, you know, by doing things like getting rid of this black and white binary thinking of demons are always evil and angels are always good, and everything's these clearly defined boxes that things fit into, which has no corollary in reality. We all know this. You know, freeing ourselves from that and thinking of things more realistically and more with more complexity. And it's just much richer storytelling opportunities there, and a lot of fun and discovery to be had. And it also kind of gets you away from that thing of, oh, there's a goblin. It's this alignment. It has this many hit points, and players reciting stats from the monster manual from you. You know, if in your world, you can't just assume that every goblin is evil and that every goblin is irredeemable, then you can't just go kill them with abandon either. You might actually have to role play. Oh my God. You might have to socially interact with the goblins first before you cut them down. That all sounds good to me. And finally, the last cool thing about this, I think, is it keeps beings in your world from getting samey and cookie cutter. As soon as you say not every angel is lawful good, you have variety. As soon as I say not every angel of Hades, which is a subtype now, not every reaper is lawful evil, there's potential for variety in story there. As soon as I say not every red dragon is chaotic evil, there's potential for character and story and interesting things there. Every red dragon being chaotic evil, that's boring. That's not very creative. That's not very much fun. There's nothing to learn there. But if every dragon is an individual, if every angel, every insert monster X is an individual that makes their own choices and has their own personality that may or may not align with the stereotype for that type of monster, that's a pretty interesting world that I'd want to play in. All right, well, that is going to wrap up episode 103 of Game Master's Journey. I hope you enjoyed the episode today, and I really hope that I do hear from you. I would love to hear from you what you think about the cleric. Do you think that it is less desirable to some or many players than the other classes? And if so, why do you think that might be? And is there anything we can do to make the cleric more attractive to players? And if so, what can we do? I hope that you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music provided by Cloudwalker, Renfield, Tranceboy, and Ish. Please see the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney.